In Saudi Arabia, Prince Mohammed bin Salman's campaign to, much vaunted campaign to stamp out corruption and usher in a new and more open brand of Islam has been greeted with considerable enthusiasm by much of the world and, yes, by many younger Saudis. Among the other things, the crowd prince vowed to curb the power of the clerics and religious police, to grant women more space in public life, and seems to have been behind the initiative to allow Saudi women to finally drive their own cars, promised to end corruption, increase transparency. But then came reports of the arrest and detention of hundreds of powerful businessmen. And this week, in a significant development, the New York Times reported that many of those detained had been hospitalised for physical abuse, and at least one man died in custody. So what's going on? Is it about ending corruption or consolidating power? I'm delighted to be joined by Ben Hubbard, the New York Times Middle East correspondent, who broke the story of coercion and abuse. And Ben's on the blower from his home in Beirut. Ben, welcome.
Thank you.
Ben, some quick background first. Prince Mohammed, who is he exactly, and why is he pushing so hard for a reform agenda?
Well, so Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman is a relatively young son of King Salman. He was a virtually unknown character before 2015, when the previous monarch died and his father became king. And then since then, he's just been on this kind of rocket path toward the top of the Saudi power structure, just getting new jobs, getting promoted, reasserting himself, sidelining his rivals. And he has, you know, by now it's very clear that he is the acting ruler and the most powerful person in Saudi Arabia, with the exception of his father, who is the elderly monarch. But this guy is a real mover and shaker who is doing all kinds of things in the kingdom and throughout the entire Middle East.
So what seems to be the motivation? He wants to attract foreign investment so it can get beyond the dependence on oil. And yes, he has to soften the image of the kingdom. What kind of reforms has he enacted thus far?
Well, he has rolled out an incredibly ambitious reform program. I forgot to mention in introducing him as a character that he's 32 years old. So when he began his rise, he was 29 and, didn't have much of kind of a long public biography for people to know where he got all this, all this sort of experience and knowledge. And now he's the head of the armed forces. He's the crown prince. So he will be the next person to inherit the throne. He's sort of running economic policy. He's on the board of the state oil company. So this guy really has all of the levers of power basically within his direct reach.
Okay, he has the levers, yeah. But does he have the depth of knowledge? Where was he educated, for example?
Well, he was unlike many of his brothers and half-brothers, he never spent any significant time abroad. He does now speak English sometimes in interviews, but his English is not fluent by any means. He was educated. He received his degree in law from a university in Riyadh. It's a bit unclear where he comes with all of this. I mean, he is incredibly ambitious, and he laid out over the last few years some just incredibly ambitious reform programs that are basically intended to transform almost all aspects of life in Saudi Arabia. He released a large program called Saudi Vision 2030, which is supposed to be where it's supposed to provide kind of a goal for where Saudi Arabia wants to be in the year 2030, which includes all sorts of things, economic things, social things. He wants to diversify the Saudi economy so that it's less dependent on oil revenue. He wants to increase the place for women in public life. He's going to, this June, women are supposed to be able to be allowed to drive for the first time in Saudi history, basically. He's also trying to increase entertainment options. This was a very stern, button-down place that was where social life was sort of constricted by very conservative Islamic clerics. He has gotten rid of a lot of that, and now the government is putting billions of dollars into building an entertainment industry. They want to have movie theaters. They want to have concerts. During my recent visit, I went to the opera, which was something that one just didn't do in Saudi Arabia before. So this guy is incredibly, incredibly ambitious with where he wants to take the kingdom. But I think at the same time, there are a number of things that have happened along the way in the last few years that have raised questions, I would say, both about his judgment and about his sort of strategic thinking about how to accomplish some of these things. Most of the things in his plan, there's really nothing to disagree with. Everybody would agree, I think with probably no exceptions, that you know, Saudi Arabia needs to diversify its economy away from oil. I think most people would agree that you have to find a way to make life a little bit more enjoyable for all, you know, for young Saudis who have been frustrated with this constricted social life. But, you know, along the way, there have been sort of a number of misadventures or misfires or things that just didn't work out. And, the things on that list would certainly be the war in Yemen, which he, as the defense minister, is in charge of. This is something that I think the Saudis thought they could wrap up fairly quickly. And then a few years later, here we are. And it's, you know, become this tragic, tragic humanitarian situation inside of Yemen. And they don't really seem to have any kind of way out. The most recent thing, which was the story that we published on Sunday, was this, you know, anti-corruption campaign, which, you know, again, I think anybody who's spent time in the kingdom or businessmen who have worked there or invested there, everybody will tell you that, yeah, corruption was a huge problem and that it used to be the kind of place where you would be about to do a deal and then all of a sudden some prince would show up or some middleman would show up and find a way to get in and get a cut or get a finder's fee or a success fee. That frustrated everybody who was trying to do business there. So again, on one hand, everybody is very, you know, nobody would disagree. Nobody would say, oh, no, they don't need to fight corruption. I mean, everybody would agree that getting rid of corruption, providing more transparent environment for business and for the economy is a net gain for everybody who's involved.
Okay, so let's now look.
How does he go about it?
Let's now look at the dark side of the story, which you've revealed to the world, and that's that in November, or from November, the Saudi government started arresting hundreds of influential Saudis. I understand that the Bin Laden family, who are, in a sense, the Rockefellers of the region and offspring of King Abdullah, have been caught in the net. Who else?
Well, there were a whole range of people. There were, you know, a number of very prominent princes, a number of princes who were sons of the previous king, sons of previous kings, not just the previous king, but sons of previous kings. Probably the most recognized international figure would be Prince Al-Walid bin Talal, who was, you know, a grandson of the first king of Saudi Arabia. This guy was the world, you know, the Saudi Arabia's most famous international investor. This guy used to, you know, travels the world and has stakes in Four Seasons and Lyft and Citigroup and all these various different things, gets his picture taken with Michael Jackson. And, you know, this guy was an international figure that people knew, and he ended up in the Ritz.
Was this the bloke who was very supportive of Rupert Murdoch?
I don't know that much about their relationship, but he had all kinds of, you know, deep international business ties. You know, he's a co-investor with Bill Gates in the Four Seasons and, you know, many, many, many other people.
Okay, are the Trumps involved in this, in the region?
The Trumps do not have, as far as we're well, any direct investments in Saudi Arabia. The Trump Organization definitely has investments in the United Arab Emirates, which is next door. They have a golf course and resort that opened soon after the election. And they have some other projects there underway that are done by the Trump Organization. But there's no Trump-branded property anywhere inside of Saudi Arabia.
I mention it because Jared Kushner spent some time there in undisclosed meetings. But it is clear that Trump has what is described as a warm relationship with the prince who's about to go to the U.S. to court that foreign investment. Ben, you report that the Saudi government hasn't specified why it arrested these quite illustrious detainees. What have you gathered about the reasons?
Well, I think in the general sense it has said why. It just basically said that we need to crack down on corruption and we need to do that from the top. So we need to hit the really big people that were involved in it. And then the idea is that this will trickle down through the bureaucracy and let everybody know that those old ways of doing things you just can't do anymore. So that's about as much as the Saudi government has said. What they have not said is they have never released the actual names of who was in the Ritz. So a lot of it has just been, you know, things that we've picked up from other sources, but the government will not confirm nor deny anybody who was actually inside of the Ritz. And they also have never said who was found guilty in this process that they had inside of the hotel and who was found innocent. So according to the government, they had, I think, just over 380 people who were part of this process. Many of them were actually what I guess you would consider in a Western legal system material witnesses, people who had information or had been involved in transactions that, you know, may have led to charges against other people. But the government has provided absolutely no information on who among those 380 people was innocent and who was guilty. So it sort of let them out, but then everybody's kind of been tarred by the brush of corruption You know, and so there's a bit of irony in the government saying at the beginning that we want to do this because we need a more transparent business environment, and then to sort of go through this entire process with an incredible lack of transparency.
I'm talking to Ben Hubbard, and Ben is the Middle East correspondent for the New York Times. I love the idea of house arrest at the Ritz-Carlton. That's very Saudi. But let's now get to the revelation that several of the detainees seem to have suffered abuse, and one, a general indeed, died, and his body showed signs of torture.
Yes, and this is something that has been, it's been very murky. I mean, the government has tried to move on very quickly and sort of make it appear that this was a formal legal process and it wrapped up and now everything is cool and, you know, just everyone kind of wants everybody to move on. And but the more that we looked into what had happened to the detainees, one is that, okay, they've been released, but they're not exactly free. Many of these big businessmen are now wearing ankle bracelets that track their movements. They're not free to move. Their accounts are still frozen in many cases. They're banned from traveling outside of the kingdom. Some of them are watched very closely by guards. And so that's one of the reasons that we haven't been able to just go and interview people who were in the Ritz and say, okay, what happened to you? And, you know, the more time that's gone by, we've gotten much more information about the kind of tactics that were used inside. So we know from medical sources who were in the hospitals close by that there were at least 17 people early on who were brought in after being roughed up by their captors. So they were brought in for medical treatment. And then we also knew about this case of one of the detainees who died based on his stay in the Ritz. And people who saw the body said that he was, you know, his body had clearly been abused in some way. His neck was twisted in an unnatural way, and his skin showed signs of what looked like it could have been electric shock. So, you know, we reported these out. We got as close as we could to talking to people who knew the family, people who had seen the body, and, you know, contacted the Saudi government as we always do to give them a chance to, you know, give their side of the story. And they issued a blanket statement that said, of course, there was no abuse whatsoever that took place, but they have not acknowledged that this man died after his time in the Ritz, and they have never given the story of how they think that he died. So that's what we're left with. I mean, we still don't have absolute clarity on the extent of the abuse. Our impression, I think, is that it was a bit more common in the early days. This would have been in November when the process started, when they were bringing people in. But we also know that people that weren't physically abused, you know, there was a lot of psychological pressure used on these people. I mean, they were in the Ritz-Carlton, which is generally, I assume, a pretty nice hotel to stay in. But, you know, they were also being held against their will, and we know that there were other tactics used, sleep deprivation. People were interrogated, forced to wear hoods while they were interrogated so they couldn't see their interrogators. There was, you know, lots of other ways besides physical abuse that the Saudi government could coerce them into signing over assets.
Well, that's the next part of the story, because one of the assets are being seized, and one of the assets is a quite powerful media company, MBC, and Prince Mohammed has previously shown interest in buying. Is this a strange method of acquiring profitable businesses?
Yeah, there were a number of cases like this came up. I mean, again, anybody who knows the history of Saudi Arabia, and from what we know from the guest list, there were many people, I mean, if we want to call it the guest list at the Ritz or the detainee list, there were many, many people on the list that pretty much everybody agreed, yeah, these guys were corrupt. You know, we knew that that was the case. Everybody knew that that was the case, but that's the way that the system operated. So, you know, there was definitely a reason to make a move in some kind of way to go after corruption. But then we had these other cases that really sort of raised questions about, well, is that exactly what's going on in all these cases? And one of them, as you mentioned, was the case of MBC. So for anybody who doesn't know the Arab world, MBC is by far the largest private media company. It owns, I think, around 10 different satellite television stations. Not particularly political. It's mostly entertainment channels. You know, they show movies, they show Oprah, they show, you know, Arab's Got Talent, The Voice, lots of those kinds of shows. But this is a media network with an incredible reach inside of the Arab world. I mean, incredible soft power to sort of shape views and really get inside of millions of homes every day. And it's owned by a Saudi. And so we found out a Saudi who was locked up in the Ritz in the very early days of this crackdown. And so once we started investigating, okay, well, why did they go after him? you know, somebody who has long-term links to the royal family, and the channel, the original channel for NBC had actually been started with money from a previous king. But then we found out, okay, but they had been in talks about buying it for the last 2 years, for since 2015. And then in October of last year, they brought in some accountants from PwC who actually came in from the United Kingdom, came to vet the books and do the due diligence and find out how much the company was actually worth. And then after they started their study, sure enough, the owner, or a number of the owners, the main shareholders and the majority of the members of the board, ended up getting locked in the Ritz. So, you know, this obviously raises questions about,
Ben, you won't be the most popular young man in the region, will you?
I'm sorry, who? Sorry?
You will not be the most popular young man in the region. These your stories, these revelations, will be considerably embarrassing to Prince Mohammed, who's about to arrive in the U.S.
It's not something I think too much about. I mean, I obviously don't work for Saudi Arabia. I work for the readers of the New York Times. And so, you know, we felt that it was our duty to explain as much as we can about what this guy is up to. And if he would like to go to the U.S. and try to drum up foreign investment, that's fine. That's his right to do so. But we just felt that it was important that people had, as much information as possible about kind of the economic decisions that he's making at home and what the environment is there. The flip side of that, I think we also need to say that we did not come up with any evidence that he had seized any foreign assets inside of the kingdom, any foreign investments. So we didn't find any cases of American or British or, you know, businessmen from elsewhere in the world saying, wow, you know, my accounts got frozen and I lost a bunch of money. So they seem to have recognized that would have been a very unpopular move. We also didn't find clear cases of them seizing foreign assets, as in Saudi assets that were held outside of the kingdom. So whether or not they sort of ran into checks in the international financial system, or maybe they just decided that again would be something that would raise flags in the West and decide not to do it is not entirely clear. But what they primarily seized were domestic assets owned by Saudis, land, shares of companies, cash in the bank, things like that.
Ben, you've done a great job, and thank you very much for coming on the program. Ben Hubbard, the Middle East correspondent for the New York Times, based in Beirut. Good on you, Ben.
Thank you very much.